Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 326 for April 1st of 2016, Not Your Soccer Mom's Minivan. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Auto Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Gary Vasilash.
John, how are you?
Doing great. It's great to be back in the studio.
Back from New York.
Yeah, that was a great show that we did last week.
It was.
In New York,
hadn't come back with a cold, I would have been happier, but it was a good
job. Oh, you caught a cold in New York,
oh, yeah.
Eh?
Oh, yeah.
Too bad. Go sit in a sauna. That's my advice. Sweat it out of it.
I'll work on that.
Okay. So we got to let everybody know we got Pete Bigelow back from Autoblog. Pete, great having you here in the studio.
Thank you for having me back. It's nice to be here.
And of course, you were on the Pacifica launch, the Chrysler Pacifica launch, and we've got one of them in the studio. And the reason we got that in the studio is we also have Mike Downey, the chief engineer for the Chrysler Pacifica. Mike, great having you on Autoline After Hours.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So the last time there was an all-new Pacifica was 2008, right?
Yes. Yep.
And here you guys with... So this is all new. Now, when some people say all new, they mean like a little bit new. This is all new. Tell us what you guys did.
Absolutely. This is absolutely an all new Chrysler Pacifica minivan from the ground up. We started right from the platform itself. We said we wanted to start a new platform, something that would able to give us some of the great things of great ride, great handling, quietness of the car. Those are some of the first attributes. So we really wanted to start right from the beginning, right from the bones. And we said, we need a minivan with a great backbone. We feel the minivan, the segment itself, with the inherent nature of a sliding door, makes it hard to really have a great platform, like a sedan-type architecture. And we said, you know what? We need that. A minivan industry needs it. So that's how we kind of started out with an all-new platform. So it is entirely new platform, different than the Town and Country.
Mm-hmm.
And we really tried to emphasize that torsion bending of the underbody architecture, and we ended up actually nearly doubling the torsional stiffness from the exiting Town and Country, and that really formed the backbone of what we feel the driving experience that you get out of the Pacifica. You can really feel it's got a great backbone, and we turn one of the weaknesses of having the sliding door into really the strength of it by using that center section where we have our tub to be the main backbone architecture and strength of the Pacifica's architecture.
You must have looked at Honda and Toyota, too, because with the Sienna and the Odyssey, they've moved ahead of sales of the old Town and Country and the Caravan. Although, if you put the Dodge and the Chrysler together, it still was number one in the segment. But they had gone ahead of you guys. And I got to believe you must have torn their vans apart, too, to see what you had to do to beat them.
Absolutely, yes. Benchmarking, especially when you do a new architecture or even when you just do a top hat, benchmarking is the first place you start at. So a couple of, good competitive set of vehicles that we had there, we understood it. We understood where they were at, and they understood that some of their weaknesses as well. We understood that that's how we realized for the minivan segment, all of the minivans really kind of lacked that torsion and bending stiffness. And we would drive other competitive sets, and we could feel it. We could feel that there was a weakness. And that's how we kind of started off saying, we can't be, even though they may be in the market, we know we can do a lot better than where they were at. So the architecture that we set out really was using them as our starting point, and we really leapfrogged where they're at. And that driving experience that we feel as when we drive our Pacifica, we drive the competitive set, we drive our Town and Country, we really feel how we've leapfrogged the industry of the minivans.
Now, you mentioned that you use the tub as a component to get more torsional rigidity. And Pete, I know that when I drove it over the Ortega Highway, which I'm sure you drove it over the Ortega Highway at speeds that we would ordinarily drive things that are not minivans, that you could feel that. Now, so before the tub was a separate piece, and now it's integrated into
right.
the...
And explain what you mean by tub.
Yes,
I'm not sure what you mean.
Let's start at the beginning. So The Chrysler Pacifica, and really all in the town and country as well, has a what we call our stow-and-go tub. So right in the middle, if you open up your sliding door and you look on the middle of the floor pan, there's a tub on both sides for the middle row, right side and left side. That tub is actually the storage space for the stow-and-go seats. So we have the Chrysler exclusive, they have the ability to fold your seats right into the floor and then put your load flow over it, so you have all the storage capability that you would want. So the tub that you can see there, it could also be used for storage. On the current Town and Country, the body in white structure is just a hole. So as you're going through the body shop, you can see a hole, and then later, as we went through the trim shop, you'd put in basically plastic fillers that were less structural, if you will. So for the Pacifica, we said, We need to strengthen that. That's the backbone of the car. It's right in the middle of the car. And those tubs that inherently could be a weak point, we said, let's turn that into structure. So now in the body in white structure, when you take out all the plastic parts, the carpet parts, and you look inside of that tub, those are steel parts. Those are steel parts that structurally tie the front end of the vehicle with the back end of the vehicle. And that's what really gives us a lot of that backbone of the entire vehicle.
Gotcha.
So I happen to own one of those 2016 Town and Countries, and it's fascinating to go from my car at the airport to driving the new Pacifica in California. And one of the chief things I noticed was how much quieter this car was.
Right.
I was wondering if you could talk about some of the things you did to make it more quiet and some of the active noise cancellation technology in the car.
Yeah, you brought up active noise cancellation. That's probably where it all starts, right? Standard active noise cancellation. Every Pacifica has it, regardless of your price class. So active noise cancellation is basically we have microphones in the headliner of the vehicle. It takes in the noise in the cabin, and then we send out actually another noise that's opposite, equal in strength but opposite in frequency to counteract that noise. So even though the noise may be airborne, your ears don't hear it. It's canceled by the sound system that we have. And that we found that to be a huge benefit to the noise.
And it reacts fast enough, even though it's measuring the noise in the cabin.
Okay. Absolutely,
because you'd think the noise would get to your ear as fast as it would get to the microphone.
It's an incredible technology, and we feel it, right. We drive them with and without the active noise cancellation, and it is incredibly effective. And that's one of the big enablers. The other enabler, really, is what I talked about, is just the torsion and stiffness, the bending, the amount that our cars, the Pacifica, bends and twists and moves, that things that changes pressure inside the cabin is reduced, and that just naturally reduces the amount of sound that you have. And then probably the third most critical thing we did was our rear suspension. So we went from basically a solid axle or twist beam suspension, went to independent rear suspension. And a really unique, cool thing, well, I think one of the most unique suspension attributes that quiet is down, is we've gone to in the rear called a comfort leak suspension. And that's the bushing that attaches the trailing arm to the body. And in most suspensions, you have one bushing that attaches the suspension to the body. And you have to, in most applications, most people compromise. They say, I want a really tight handling, but I want a soft ride. So if you make the bushing really soft, your handling is mushy. If you make the bushing really strong, then it's harsh in the back end. So we said, we came up with a brilliant idea, which we love and really can feel it in the car, called this comfort link. And it takes the one bushing that's a compromise, we put it into two bushings, and they're 90 degrees to each other. One bushing that's up-down is stiff, so we have great handling, and the bushing that controls the harshness is very soft, so it makes for that soft ride. So it got us into a no-compromise position, so we didn't have to compromise between the ride and the ride quality and the steering.
This new way sounds more expensive, so clearly you're investing more in the product than in the past.
Yeah, it's a little bit more, not a lot. Absolutely well worth it. And we had both designs. We drove both designs, and in the quietness, especially the back end quietness of the car, was just there's no way we couldn't do it. And the whole theme was no compromises, right? We do not want to make compromises. You engineer a car, you make trade-offs every day. And you want the customer to have, you want to have it all, but then physics catches up and you say, oh, I have to give up some noise, give some steering. And we had a solution that said, this truly gives them both a great ride and then the great noise as well. So all those things, I think the active noise cancellation, the tight twisting and bending, and then the rear suspension, independent rear suspension, as well as the comfort link, really makes it a really quiet vehicle. So, data, always like engineers like talking data. So we have a measure called articulation index, which measures how clearly you can hear voices in the car. We have industry best 83% articulation index on the Pacifica, outstanding number. And you can just, when you drive down, as I tell everybody, you spew all these numbers and all these facts. But when you're in the car, just try to talk to the person next to you. And it's amazing how well you can hear the person. So that's really the proof is in the pudding. When we drive those cars, we're like, this articulation index thing, which probably is, you know, a bunch of mumbo jumbo, it's real. And when you know, drive it compared to our competitive set and compared to the existing exiting town and country, it's a much quieter vehicle.
Is that more challenging to accomplish in a minivan than in, say, a sedan?
Yeah, overall quietness in a minivan, just the segment itself, is because of the sliding door. The sliding door in the middle structure is inherently weaker. So first of all, the sliding doors are large sliding doors. Wind noise is always inherently more difficult than a triple-sealed sedan door. So sliding doors in the whole industry is more difficult to make it quiet. And then, as you know, as I spoke of earlier, the vehicle stiffness is harder to achieve. So generally, minivans had been more noisy in the whole industry, and I think we're taking... we really wanted to say we want this to be a sedan-like experience. So we think we're able to really get that a lot closer to a sedan.
Mm-hmm. And you've lowered this compared to the last Town and Country. Did that have any effect on engineering the vehicle?
Yeah, well, it helped. Lowering it definitely helped for our aerodynamics.
Now, less ground clearance or just lower roof height?
Same, but 150 millimeters of ground clearance, so comparable to where we were. The height of the car itself was slightly lowered, about 11 to 12 millimeters lower. Definitely helped for aerodynamics. So the less aerodynamic drag helps the wind noise on the outside as well. We also, you know, talking about aerodynamics is another great accomplishment that we did, you know, for quietness, another great enabler for quietness. We have a 0.3 CD drag coefficient for this Town and Country. So extremely low number. It's a sedan-like number that we're very proud of. It helped both for our fuel economy, our unsurpassed fuel economy, as well as it helps quiet the car down. It has to push the car through less air with that lower drag.
You said 0.30.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I definitely noticed, you know, looking at my fuel economy throughout the drive in California, we were...
What were you getting?
I was getting 25, 26 miles per gallon, and that was in a lot of stop-and-go highway driving. So compared to my Town and Country again, which is kind of what I had in my head the entire drive, that was a significant improvement.
Yeah. Yeah, talk to us about the powertrain.
Yeah, so the powertrain, we're really excited about the powertrain. It's the upgraded Pentastar V6 engine, 287 horsepower with it. So it comes with our upgraded Pentastar, outstanding engine, better than the previous Pentastar. It's more efficient, more lightweight, has more power. And that's teamed up with our 9-speed torque flight transmission, we spent countless hours tuning in the transmission. 9-speed transmission, it's outstanding for fuel economy. We really were able to tune that transmission. It's a great fit with the V6 and the higher torque engine.
How did you work with the design staff? And the reason I'm asking is, you know, when you get a minivan, it's all about interior space.
Yep.
And you don't want to compromise it. This is why people buy minivans, because they need that interior space. So how did you work with them? Did you set the parameters and then said, okay, you guys can do whatever you want as long as you don't violate this? Or did they say, here's the look we want, now make it fit to the engineering side?
Yeah, and the answer is both. The answer is both, right? So certainly when you're creating a car, you start with in the sketch phase. And so our design office, outstanding design office, had, you know, beautiful looking sketches. And from there, we kind of get into then we start technicalizing it, if you will, and we create the hard points. So, you know, we kind of drove, like, the length of the car. We have the identical length of the Pacifica versus the Town and Country. So we kind of used that to mold the sketches as we got into the clay phase. And then from there, we said, like you said, we wanted the interior to be even more. So we ended up, one of the great enablers we did that really makes the stance more bold is we increased the track, the distance between the wheels and plan view, 4 inches. But in the overall width of the vehicle is only 1 inch wider. So we gave a lot to the customer on the inside.
How did you do that? 4 inches is a lot.
Yep. So we ended up pulling two on each side. So we ended up pulling the wheels more outboard, if you will, but still maintaining it underneath the body side aperture. So we did. We took so that ended up giving us nearly 200 cubic feet of interior space. So it's we have even more space than what we had. The utility of a minivan, right? That's why people buy it. They want to get their kids in and out. They want to have a lot of stuff. They want to be able to load, you know, 4x8 pieces of plywood. So that was an absolute requirement as we were working and designing back and forth with the design office.
So the width of this versus the width of Pete's is?
About 25 millimeters wide.
So that's just 1 inch.
Yeah. Yep.
But yet you've got that
additional track, yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's impressive.
So it helps on the inside, right? So if anybody could have just pushed the wheels way out and then just made the car wider, would hurt your aerodynamics, would hurt your fuel economy. But we had room to give underneath where the position of the wheel wells and the tires to be able to accomplish that.
So now you're going to look at your car and say, wow, those tires are way back there.
I know. It's a shame that I got it just last year, and I don't need to replace it for a while, because now I know what the newer sibling is. And
you know, I also find it remarkable. I mean, you guys have the 9-speed, and you know, the way you've cleaned it up, there's you got a lot of room on the IP from the way you shift the gears. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the big things for what we've got a lot of features, right? We have a beautiful 8.5 inch screen, disassociated screen, which we love, where we've taken the screen and, you know, like a packaging problem is you have a big screen, you have a big radio, takes up a lot of space on your instrument panel. So one of the unique things we did is we went to what we call a disassociated screen for the radio, and we have just the screen. It's just like your TV set, small little thin thing that we can put on the IP. In the radio head unit itself, with all the guts and the working part, is buried deeper into the instrument panel. So it allows the guts to be far away from where the customer's at, and at the same time has a beautiful big screen. So that was one enabler that opened up a lot of packaging space.
So when you say disassociated, panel. You mean the screen is not connected to the guts?
Just
of the
with
system.
The cable. Yep, just connected with the cable.
I've never heard that term.
Yep. So it's just connected with the cable. So it's the first application that we have here at Chrysler with that. So it allows the screen to be up in the front, and then the guts buried in the back, and you just have the cable connection, kind of like you're plugging a TV into a cable box. I guess would be the best way to do it. So that opened up a lot of packaging space. Mm-hmm. We also have that, as you mentioned, the dial shift
rotary knob.
All right, so that you don't have to have all the gears to shift it down. That saves all that. You imagine all the packaging space that gives you as well. So it's opened up a lot of space for all the features that we've got. We have all our safety features and our electronic stability control, lane departure warning. We put all those buttons up in the front, easily accessible for the customer.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's John's point about people buying minivans for the interior. Was engineering the interior, the seats and the way the seats articulate and fold and move? I mean, was that almost as difficult as engineering the body structure?
Yeah, it really is, right? I mean, it's because the when you're designing the body structure, you can just be an engineer for the most part, right? People see the outside, but they don't really see what's behind it. They don't have to function the body and white as much. So structurally challenges, right? You have to apply the laws of physics for the body structure. Designing on the interior does get more challenging because you have all the human interface now, right? You just can't, like, I'm going to make this strong and I'm going to add a piece of magnesium here. It's what's the customer going to touch? What's he going to feel? How's the seat going to move? How's the seat going to feel? So it becomes a little bit more of an art, I guess, on a lot of the parts that the customer touches as opposed to the more structural part of a body and white.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of designing the interior and some of those choices, I thought it was interesting to note that and the models that have the vacuum cleaner, you know, the vacuum cleaner components took up that spot in the rear where the spare tire would be. And just that was fascinating to think of the engineering behind the vacuum cleaner of a car.
Yeah.
It's not something I'm accustomed to thinking about.
Yeah, one of the coolest things for that, right, because we want to have a vacuum cleaner. It was a really practical thing. And I think the coolest stories we had is we said, hey, you know, who else has a vacuum cleaner? We benchmarked that. Yep. And we said, "Where's their vacuum cleaner?" "Oh, it's in the back, in their tailgate." And we're like, "Well, is that where's the dirt? You want your vacuum cleaner where your dirt is? Do you want to climb in through your lift gate and then pull the hose through and then vacuum where the dirt is, or do you want the vacuum right where the dirt is?" So we said, "Well, where's the dirt?" So we actually did study. We did part of our research was to look at minivan, finding dirt. So we looked where dirt was, and we said, "Hey, the most dirt in a minivan is right when you open up the sliding door." And your kids are getting in, that's where the most dirt was. So we said, we're going to put the vacuum cleaner right where the dirt is. So that's how it ended up.
Where is it?
So it's just as you open the door, it's right in the C pillar of the door. So you open up your sliding door, it's right next to the second row seat. So you're just able to easily pull it out, and you can vacuum up your mess. Also, it has a cord long enough to reach every square inch of the van itself. And also in the back, we have an extension cord, so we can double the length. So not only can you vacuum your car, but you can vacuum your husband or wife's car next to it in the garage.
Yeah, it's just very interesting practical. The way that hose articulates in and out.
Yeah.
And just goes just right
like,
back
like
in.
Like a slinky, kind of like a slinky effect.
Yeah.
Goes back in.
Yeah.
When will this go on sale?
So it's going to be reaching dealers the middle of April, probably be in critical mass around the end of April in dealerships.
And then you got a plug-in hybrid coming, too, but that's later in the year?
Yeah,
will that be out?
Later this year, there's the plug-in hybrid. We're very excited about that. It's a 16-kilowatt battery. It's going to have 30 miles of all-electric range. It's going to get an MPGE of 80 miles per gallon city. So really practical if you don't want to use gas and you have a family. It's probably the only alternative out there. So that 30 miles, we think, is outstanding for...
That's pretty good for a vehicle that size
with the utility, and it looks just like the Pacifica. You're not going to have a stigma of looking like an electric car. If you have a lifestyle, you drive your kids to school, come back home, go to the grocery store, pick up the kids, drop off the kids at soccer. You do less than 30 miles in a day. You don't have to use gas. You come in at night, you plug it in. We have less than a 2-hour charge time with a level 2 charger, and you can go the whole week. And you don't have to go to the gas station or even burn gas. So
in this case, you're using that tub to store the batteries,
right.
Correct?
Yep. So the plug-in hybrids will use, as I mentioned, the tubs in the center of the car where the seats stow. That's where the battery goes. So you would not have stow-and-go seats, but you would replace that with the battery.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've even got a number of questions come in here from our viewers. One speaks specifically to this. Armand wants to know, did the stow-and-go tubs have to be stronger because that's where the batteries were going to go?
No, well, because the stow-and-go tubs with a hybrid car, there is no stow-and-go tub. So we replace it with regular flat sheet metal. So the stow-and-go tubs are the backbone of the gas car. And then with the hybrid, we have a different structure that we put in that replaces the stow-and-go.
Do you lose any of that structural rigidity?
No, absolutely not. We actually, because without the tub, we have straight rails, and we're able to maintain the rigidity that we have in the gas car.
Don Wagner wants to know, why recycle the Pacifica name so soon? He also goes on to say that he had a 2004 all-wheel drive, and the only problem was poor rear visibility.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I had a Pacifica too, right? When it was on, everybody says, "Why are you using the Pacifica name?" And I'm like, "That was the greatest car I ever had." So it's a great name. It's got great name recognition, and you know we really love it. I think it's.
But I
got
to believe you that the marketing people wanted a name change just so people don't think of this as a minivan.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Right, and a lot of the research we did thought of the town and country is. A lot of people would harken back, like, "Oh, that was my dad's minivan with the wood panels on the side. Or, that was my grandpa's minivan. I remember taking a trip when I was 7 in this minivan, and you know, my mom really didn't want to buy a minivan, but she bought one anyways with the town and country." So as we developed this and as we were driving the Pacifica, we're like, "This is different. This is not like the old town and countries. This is light years ahead of what it is." We thought it deserved a new name, and we loved the name Pacifica. So it was a good marriage.
Rogerio wants to know, and he says, by the way, he's a prospect for you guys.
Okay.
Is the plug-in version primarily an EV with an onboard generator like a Volt, or will the gas engine drive the vehicle when the battery is depleted like the Fusion Energy?
Yeah, it's a parallel system. So as you're in charge depletion mode, the motors in your transmission is driven through the battery. Then as you're in what we call charge sustaining. You have both the electric and the gas-powered motor in parallel working with it.
He also wants to know, will the battery be liquid-cooled?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And he wants to know, what kind of take rate do you think you'll get for the plug-in version?
Yeah, it's speculative at this point, so we're still trying to work through that.
Depends on the price.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you still have the same Pentastar engine in the plug-in hybrid version?
Yeah, it's a slightly modified. It is the Pentastar engine, slightly modified to be efficient with the hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Argel Brian Augustin says, "What about the Chrysler Pacifica Trail Hauler, the 770 horsepower all-wheel drive minivan? I just want to see it even in concept form."
No one's working on that yet. It's a great idea. I'll take it back.
Let's see. And Philip wants to know, please explain the active noise control functions from this standpoint. Is it to reduce road noise, powertrain noise, intake exhaust noise?
Mostly for powertrain noise, for the most part. And that's why it's a great, it's actually active noise cancellation for us was really another great fuel economy enabler. In general, some of the best noise that it cancels out is the powertrain noise. So as you talk about compromises, so one of the big compromises of all cars with when you're calibrating your engine is how loud you want your engine to be versus how efficient it is. So many times if, oh, the engine, you're getting a lot of engine noise, you have to do things in the calibration that would make it less fuel efficient. So this the active noise cancellation really allows our engine to be a little bit louder. We don't have to calibrate that out, and we use the ANC, the active noise cancellation, to allow the engine to be more biased towards fuel efficiency as opposed to being biased towards noise. Mm-hmm. So it was really really one of the great enablers, and it got us some improved fuel economy as well.
And Kayville wants to know, what's the towing capacity compared to other minivans and crossovers?
Yep. We're 3,600 pounds. We're right on that. But the whole minivan industry is right in that 35 to 3,600 pounds for the gap.
Did anything surprise you when you were looking at the other minivans, what they did, and you said, well, that's interesting?
No, they're both our competitors are pretty mainstream, pretty fundamental. I think we pride ourselves in it looking like we think they kind of copied us on a lot of the things that we did. So some of the things looked familiar to us because they were kind of, we thought, copying from us. But, they're pretty fundamental. I don't think there's anything that we would, that we really would say, let's copy that. Mm-hmm. We thought we had some great ideas on our own.
Toyota Sienna on the top line model, I think that's the XLE. They've got captain's chairs in the middle row with footrests that come up.
Yep.
You ever think of doing that? Because I thought that was terrific. I think it's one of the best middle row seats in the business.
Yeah, well, and we love, for our minivan, we love the Stow & Go. The customers love it. They love the tubs. They love to be able to put the seats all the way down, be able to get plywood on there. Put my wife on our minivans we had for 15 years. And we have the video games and toys and balls, and we use that extra. It's another 4.5 cubic feet of storage. And we use that like crazy. So with that, we'd love to have the Stow & Go, and that Stow & Go is what we really, we think our customer really, really enjoys.
And you guys went all out with the infotainment systems in this vehicle.
Oh, yeah. That all-new theater system that we've got. And it really is a theater system, right? So it's more than just a video player. It does have a Blu-ray DVD. One of the coolest things, though, it also has eight game apps. So it's got tic-tac-toe and checkers and a Hangman version, and Sudoku. So it's really great. For our Pacific Arc, my kids used to always want, they would always yell at shotgun. They always try to get in the front seat. And for now, especially with our entertainment system, we can play games against each other. So you can play tic-tac-toe or checkers against each other. So my kids always run in the second row now and try to play the video game. So that the infotainment system is outstanding. We've got, you can see there, the are we there yet? So it kind of answers that age-old question is, when the kid's in the back, are we there yet? And there's actually one of the eight apps is that. So it'll tell the kid in a nice pictorial methodology of how long until the trip's over. So they don't have to ask you anymore. One less thing to ask.
Bet you wish you had that, huh?
I definitely do. And one of my other favorite features was the fact that, one could watch one movie at one time and the other can watch something entirely different on their screen. And thought, do you know how many fights that would avert on a family road trip?
Yeah, it's great. And also comes with the headsets where you can be listening in on the different screens. And also another real cool feature is the remote control. So it's got a touchpad remote control as well. So if a child's smaller, they can't reach the screens, can use the touchpad of the remote, can play the games, can control what video and audios they're listening to.
And you must be thrilled with the styling that design staff gave you, because I got to tell you, I hear people who say they hate minivans say they like the Pacifica.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We've got nothing but rave reviews on the appearance, right? It's kind of what we're going for is it wants to be the cool mom or the cool dad now. Right? That's what it doesn't want to be that old paneled minivan. So it is. There's no doubt it's absolutely beautiful on the outside. Our design office just churns out one great looking car after another, and this is just another in a long line of beautiful looking cars from Chrysler.
And the minivan presents that challenge of you have to start with sliding doors, and the design, I would think would have to start at that basic foundational level.
Absolutely, yep. It sets the middle of the car and the whole silhouette of it, so it's where it's got, where it has to start.
Well, good. Mike Downey, thanks so much for stopping by and bringing a Pacifica into the studio. This is really these two guys have driven it. I haven't driven it yet. I'm dying to get into this thing.
Great. Love to have you in one. Well, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Good deal. We're going to take a quick commercial break, give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. We'll be back to talk all about the news of the industry of the week. Okay, we're back. And we're back to talk to Dr. Data.
Yes, indeed.
There's got to be a number, right?
All right, so this is a very perplexing set of numbers here, and I'm hoping that you guys are going to be able to figure this out for me, because for the life of me, I cannot figure this out. So Carmen, could you bring the first number up, please? All right, so here's a couple figures here. So this is March 7th through 10th, 2013.
So back then,
we were paying $3.74 a gallon for gasoline. So Gallup went out and asked people, what is your level of support for alternative energy? So you think that people might be rather supportive.
This is a Gallup poll?
Gallup poll.
Okay.
Right? So 59% of the respondents to the poll said alternative energy.
And they'd pay more for it?
They were looking for, we got to do this. So, Carmen, please bring up the second. So here we are in 2016, 3 years later. Price of a gallon of gas, $1.87 a gallon. Support for alternative energy, 73%. So let's look at these side by side here. Okay, so it's almost inverse. So doesn't it seem that when gasoline costs more, that there would be greater support for finding sources of alternative energy? Yet we find that gasoline is cheaper, and the number of support, it's
gone up.
It's gone up. What's the deal?
Have people put their money where their mouth is when they've made their purchasing decisions would be the third number I'd like to see alongside there.
In what regard?
Well, are they buying products that would fit into that alternate energy mindset, such as a Pacifica hybrid, or are they going to go with the regular Pacifica? I think, maybe with climate change, garnering more attention in the last few years, maybe that's influenced that number independent of gas price in terms of support for alternative energy. But, I still see people rushing out to buy SUVs today. So if 70-something truly do support alternate energy alternatives, why are they making the purchasing decisions that don't reflect that value?
What do you think?
I'm stunned at these numbers. I don't get the inverse ratio thing, that when gas prices are high, fewer people support alternative energy. Now gas prices are cheap, and 79% say that they support it. One thing I'd say is, kind of to Pete's point, don't listen to what people say. Watch what they do. Because, going back a few years ago, there were polls that were done of how much more would you pay for a car that got better fuel economy. And people were talking about thousands of dollars. They'd happily pay more for a hybrid and even more for an electric. And then they'd go into the showroom and they go, ooh, I want the heated steering wheel and the premium sound system and the fill in the blank. But they would never buy the alternatives. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think, Gary?
I was beginning to think that maybe people feel more comfortable. Okay, gas is cheap, and you think, maybe it'd be a good idea that maybe they had to, look into alternative fuels. Maybe we had to make some investments because, this isn't taking it out of my wallet every week when I'm, going to fill up my town and country or what have you, right? I mean, and so it's just the comfort level with their own economic conditions. I mean, I heard today that the first quarter of this year is the least amount of money that we've paid for gasoline on average in 12 years. But
wow.
But the funny part is that, I thought it was funny that they said the amount of money that we have extra in our wallets in this period of time is $45. So that's the difference it means. It would seem to me that'd be much higher. But speaking of alternatives, big night tonight, huh?
Yes, it is.
Model 3, Tesla's Model 3 tonight, which will be a blowout media extravaganza.
So Pete, tell us what the Model 3 is for those who don't know.
It's essentially an affordable Tesla electric car for the masses that Elon Musk has talked about developing for many years now. This is kind of a key component of his plan to bring electric cars to everybody and at an affordable price. So I think we're talking about starting at $35,000 before the credits for buying the car, and you know, perhaps we get somewhere south of $30,000 for a all electric car that gets a 200-mile all electric range.
Yeah,
What do you think?
Well, look, I think the car is going to be fantastic. I think the two cars that Tesla, I guess I should say three cars if you count the Roadster and the S and the X. But I think what Tesla's done so far product-wise is fantastic. I expect this car to look gorgeous. I think somebody was reporting today, Bloomberg was reporting, they're expecting the range to be 225 miles,
right.
A 65-kilowatt-hour battery pack. We come back to the question that we've debated on the show is, can they make money on this car? Because we know that so far, even from an operational standpoint, they're not making any money at all. And when you throw in the whole nut, you know, amortization of the tooling and whatnot, they're losing boatloads of money. So the real question is, can they make a profit on this car? And what I find interesting is they're saying this is not a downsized Model S. This is an all-new architecture. Everything's different on it because they recognize you can't just downsize an S and go from $70,000 to $35,000. It doesn't work that way.
Well, in fact, they developed a whole new platform for this car because this will be a platform for other vehicles going forward in the showroom. So, you know, they'll have a crossover vehicle. Presumably, and Elon has even talked about the possibility they pick up, which sounds sort of crazy, but
delivery pickup, that would make a lot of sense.
You know, I think he's given us no reason to doubt some of his more audacious statements thus far. So why not a pickup? Mm-hmm. I guess.
But it's interesting. I saw a photograph today of a guy who is sitting outside a Tesla dealership. This was like, you know, he was waiting for tickets to see the Beatles or something. You know what I mean? It was just.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of lines of probably in excess of 100 people people waiting to sign up to. They're not getting their Model 3 today. They're just waiting to put their name on the list.
And
it's a $1,000 deposit.
But see,
for a car they've never seen.
One thing that I love about Tesla is that it's put a lot of excitement back into the automotive business. And the news that the announcement was coming today was all over the news. Mm-hmm. And I tried to think, you know, when was the last time I heard a mainstream car being talked up this much in the general media? God, I think you'd have to go back to the 70s or the 60s or something to get the national media saying, oh, there's a new car that's going to be announced tonight. You don't get that anymore.
Right.
Tesla's clearly been able to tap into
right.
that excitement.
So it's an Apple announcement or a Tesla announcement. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to, right? I mean, this is what excites people. Okay, so here's another question regarding this. What, if any, consequence will this have on the Chevy Bolt EV?
Ooh, interesting. Because, you know, Tesla is going to start taking deposits on this car right now. It's $1,000. You can get it refunded anytime you want, presumably. So are they going to suck a bunch of EV orders, you know, pull them up in advance, and then people are going to say, oh, I like that Bolt, but, you know, I already got a $1,000 deposit on the Model 3. I think what's going to be critical is, can they launch this Model 3 when they say they're going to, which is the end of next year? So the Bolt's going to be out for a full year before the Model 3 hits the streets. And I think a lot of people might think, and especially if, oh, there's a delay, folks, it'll be early 2019, by the way. How many people say, bugger it all, give me my $1,000 back, I want to go buy a Chevy Bolt instead?
Yeah, I think especially the other factor with that, too, is it's going to be easier to walk into a dealership and buy your Chevy Bolt than to, you know, to order a Model 3 that you're going to wait for. And clearly there's the whole Tesla versus the car dealers issue that makes it harder to go find that Model 3. So, you know, I think that combined with the fact that the Bolt is going to be available earlier, you know, really favors Chevy and, you know, their competitors in some sense. And I think that Model 3 maybe attracts a different buyer, too. So, you know, I think that it probably hurts the Model 3 a little bit, that it's just not going to be as widely available. But it won't stop the people who really want one from getting one.
So is there a finite number of people who will buy an electric vehicle of any type, or is this something that can expand?
I think it can expand. In fact, that was a big part of our discussion on last week's After Hours, you know, or I should say another show that we taped at New York that has not yet aired is, you know, Bloomberg, what's it called, New Energy Investments or whatever, they're predicting that the hockey stick, you know, chart is 2023. They're predicting that's when electric car sales will really start to take off, that batteries will continue to get smaller and cheaper and lighter. More and more charging stations will be out. They're predicting that 2023 is when sales really start to take off. In fact, they're even projecting that this could cause another collapse in oil prices.
Do you think that there's the possibility of growth?
I mean,
obviously, if you have more choices, there'll be, like, more people. But, I mean, more than just incremental growth.
More than just incremental. That changes the question a little bit. I think there's room for expansion. And, you know, I don't know if we'll see this real revolution in 2022, 2023. But, you know, I definitely see more electric cars on the road, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years as those battery prices come down. I think there's room for it to, I don't know, maybe be 4 or 5% of the market.
I mean, because you got, I mean, you know, in New York last week, Carlos Ghosn was talking about Leaf sales. And you know, and he admitted that he thought there would be more Leafs sold than have been sold.
Well, number one, let's change the styling, brother, and then see what happens. But anyway, didn't mean to interrupt.
No, but I mean to the point that if we look across the board at the available, you know, pure electric vehicles that are out there right now, I mean, it's not setting the world on fire. I mean, it just simply isn't.
No.
And I mean, and if we look at hybrid sales, I mean, Prius sales at least are fairly robust and have.
That's the end of the story. The rest of them don't sell.
At the end of the story, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I begin to wonder whether or not people are just, you know, having negative feeling about electric vehicles overall.
I think they do, especially right now. They're very expensive. They have limited range. They are not easy to plug in. You can't find charging stations everywhere. Some states, that's a little bit more different than others. But in a lot of states, you can't easily find a place to plug in. But I think we're on the verge of seeing that change. I think this 200-mile range that the Bolt and the Model 3 are going to have, I'm not going to say those are the game changers, but that's going to open up the market to a lot more people who would have otherwise said, I can't get by with 70 miles. That's just not good enough. And realistically, that's where most of these cars are now. So what do you think, Gary? Are we at a tipping point? Why do you think people don't want to buy EVs and plug-ins?
I think range at this point is still the big inhibitor. And I mean, and I think that we, you know, I think that pretty much Elon is selling every Model S he possibly can sell, which, of course, has a greater range than any other electric vehicle out there. And so then if Bolt and Model 3 come to market with a greater range, I think people are going to be more receptive to thinking about that. But still, I think these are people who maybe are slightly ahead of the curve that are you know, willing to take some risks in terms of, you know, buying something that's different. And another thing that's going to be a big factor, though, and I think this is going to play to Elon's favor that Chevy doesn't have, at least at this moment, is the fact that he has that recharging network. And has been creating that recharging network across the country, not
True.
Just in California, yep. Not one spot. So, I mean, you know, you come down to this thing of saying, okay, you know, you're pretty used to going to a gas station and spending 5 minutes pumping gasoline in your car. You know, how receptive are you going to be when you go up to a level 2 charging station and it says 3 hours and 40 minutes? You know, I mean, no
if you're
way.
Lucky, 3 hours and 40 minutes. Yeah, it's going to be more like
right.
6 hours.
But so, you know, that's a big hurdle that I think that the infrastructure build out has to happen. But people are certainly willing to pay some serious money for this. I just saw another thing that Tesla announced that sort of slipped under that the ludicrous mode that they were offering for the P90D. Well, apparently it used to be that when you bought your $108,000 P90D that you had to check the box for 10 grand to buy the ludicrous mode. Now, what does ludicrous mode mean? It means that, okay, if you buy the normal car, you go 0 to 60 in 3.1 seconds. But if you have Ludicrous, you go in 2.8 seconds.
So 10 grand for 3/10 of a second. Sounds good to me.
And now, if you have the car and you didn't buy it that way, for 10 grand, I'll let you, you'll be able to get Ludicrous mode. So it's a.
They know how to upsell their customers,
I mean,
don't they?
Just think about this.
Absolutely. Is it an over-the-air update where they add that functionality?
It is a soft grade or software upgrade, but they also have to replace the standard fuse to a, and I quote, advanced smart fuse. And then they have
to... Well, that's got to be 9 grand.
And then they have to replace the main pack connector to use Inconel rather than just normal steel to be able to handle this. But I was thinking, 10 grand for going from 3.1 seconds to 2.8 seconds?
You know, I bet if you look at performance cars out there like BMWs, you know, and what the upsell for an M series is and what the acceleration improvement might be, Tesla may not be all that far off.
Wow.
They may not be. But, you know, going back to it, too, a reason why people don't buy electrics, plug-ins, hybrids, I think a huge problem is the way that they're marketed. And I spent some time this morning looking at that advertising. And they talk about technology. Ooh, this has, you know, a 30 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery. Well, who knows what that? The public doesn't know that stuff. And you talk about, you don't have to go to the gas station as often. Well, that was the argument with diesels, too. And, you know, you're doing your part for the planet. Well, you know, as we've seen, about 3% of the new car buying public, you know, will plunk their money down to do that. So I think there are great attributes to driving EVs, and this is why I do believe that they will take off in the future. They're quiet. I mean, I'm driving a Chevy Volt that's out in the parking lot right now. It's quieter than most luxury cars. We've all talked about the instant torque, and it's so true. So if you see an opening in traffic, boom, just go for it. Bang, you're right there. And then you've got this screen, and it's showing you all the stuff. And so you try to play this game. You try to get the most braking efficiency that you can. You try to get the most range that you can on the charge that you've got. So there's fun aspects to driving these cars. You'll never see that in any of the advertising. If I were in charge of the advertising, I would tell you how this electric car is going to make your teeth whiter and improve your sex life. That's how you sell cars.
Speaking of which... What do you make of the FTC charging Volkswagen with
fraud
for selling the clean diesel?
Look, this is a clear case. I mean, you know, the Federal Trade Commission's job is to watch truth in advertising, and they've got VW called, and you know, in their ads they specifically talk, we've reduced oxides of nitrogen by 90%, when in fact, of course, they didn't do that at all. So to me, this is a slam dunk. VW's in big trouble from the EPA, the FTC, and the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, too, the FTC suit allows the FTC to share in some of the global settlements that may take place, too. So I think it's both a strategic move and, as you said, a slam dunk that, you know, this is just one more big continuous headache for Volkswagen.
Boy, those guys have just been snake bit because they had to recall all of their e-Golfs last week.
That I didn't see. So tell me.
So they're recalling nearly 6,500 electric e-Golfs cars in the U.S. to address a battery problem that can cause stalling. So basically, it's a software glitch that tells the system, like, ooh, overload, and then it just shuts the system down. So
they could figure out how to write the software to cheat on diesel emissions, but they can't figure out the software to keep their EV running.
Another software problem for
Volkswagen. It's just incredible. I mean, these poor... Oh.
Well, it'll be interesting going forward overall. I mean, I think this is a canary in a coal mine. It's maybe another issue of how many times are we going to start seeing going forward recalls for software issues?
Right.
And we saw one with Chrysler, obviously, over the summer with the Jeep hack. But here's something else, again, that's very specifically related to the software causing a safety problem.
Mm-hmm. And this is why everybody needs over-the-air updates in their cars ASAP.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you find a glitch, boom, you can fix it without the owner even knowing about it.
Absolutely, or certainly without having to go to the dealer to get it fixed, which then reduces that recall completion rate significantly.
Exactly, exactly right. Yeah.
You know, did you guys read the interview that Ryan Bean of Automotive News did with Alan Brown, who's the chairman of the Volkswagen National Dealer Advisory Council?
No.
I did not see that.
Oh my goodness! I mean, this is a great interview. I mean, and this guy. So he's in charge. I mean, he's a dealer himself. He is the general manager and partner of Louisville Volkswagen near Dallas, and so he's representing all the dealers. I mean, here's a quote from the thing. They're talking about the problem with the diesel and lack of fix. It's a train wreck for both of us, meaning the dealers and for Volkswagen. He describes, and this is an interesting thing, you know, talking about, you know, those who, you know, buy more environmentally friendly cars. Apparently, according to Brown, for our California stores, it's literally 45 to 50% of their business.
The diesel.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, just talking about some of the other issues, I thought this was interesting, talking about, you know, how is Volkswagen going to change? Because, I mean, if you look at their sales, you know, he's saying that it's you know, on the order of 300,000. You need more than that. You know, you need like half a million.
Half a million. Their goal was what, 800,000?
Yeah. And, you know, he's saying, us waiting for Europe to give us extra Tiguans when they get done taking the ones they want must be a thing of the past. I mean, can you imagine? you know, he says we've got to get going here. Passat's a great example. We know the volumes that Toyota Camry is doing, phenomenal, right?
Mm-hmm.
It just boils down to, what do we need? Is it another $1,000 or $2,000? What's going to be the tipping point that gets us moving again in that segment? But then I got to wondering, okay, if you're putting $1,000 or $2,000 on the hood of a Passat, how does that help the customer out in the long run?
In the long run, it does not, because it'll hurt your residuals, clearly. But it doesn't matter. This is full-blown, five-star, red alert, all hands on deck for Volkswagen. They got to do whatever it takes right now. They just got to bite the bullet and, number one, see if they can fix the cars. Looks like they can't fix them at all. I think they're going to have to buy them back or have some sort of other pollution offset that they do that cleans up the air. But yeah, look, this is a total disaster, and they've got to figure out what to do, and taking care of the customer and their dealers is paramount in this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if anything comes out of the National Auto Dealers Association meeting that's going on this week in Vegas regarding this.
You know, I think these comments point to the fact that this is bigger than the diesel problems, which are a huge mushroom cloud in and of themselves, but this goes to having competitive vehicles, to marketing them properly. Volkswagen's had some longstanding problems that are now coming to light.
They better not say the e-Golf cleans your teeth, by the way, because, you know, that's...
I said made them whiter.
No,
but
no,
whiter and brighter. But, you know, I just had a chance to test drive a Golf GTI a week and a half ago. What a fantastic car. Absolutely terrific. You know, it made me think, you know, this is still a great company, and yeah, bad people did bad things, but we shouldn't destroy this company by any stretch of the imagination. They really know what they're doing when they put their minds to it. But then I thought, so this car is, so it's got to be selling well, right? It's got to be at least holding its own. No. I looked at the latest sales numbers. Every single model of theirs is down, whether it has a diesel or not. So this whole scandal is clearly scaring people away from the brand, not just the diesel models.
What's fascinating is how much this has affected Volkswagen versus how little the ignition switch problems affected General Motors and their sales. I mean, Chevy sales were up, you know, right away after all the ignition switch problems and the Cobalt and other models came to light.
Well, you know, and part of the advantage for GM, right, was ignition switch, General Motors. Ooh, have you seen the new Buicks? Aren't they wonderful? You know, people didn't necessarily make the association that these four brands, Chevy, Cadillac, GMC, and Buick, were General Motors. So they hate General Motors, but they love the product that's
probably
in the showroom.
They took those little GM bugs off the side of the car. Remember when they insisted that they have GM on every GM vehicle?
Yeah.
Speaking of scary things, what do you make of the IIHS?
The headlamp.
Headlamps.
You know, fascinating.
So here's an industry that wants to give us all, you know, self-driving cars, and it turns out that you can buy a BMW 3 Series and have marginal headlamps. I mean, what's up with that?
Yeah, it was, what was interesting in that is that there was no rhyme or reason overall. I mean, the 3 Series is a perfect example of, you know, a lot of the luxury cars were the ones that did the poorest on the
BMW M or the 3 Series, the worst that they tested.
I think Mercedes-Benz C-Class was among the poor showers
CLA.
As well. CLA, yes.
Cadillac ATS. In the poor category?
Now, one of the things that they had said, and I didn't get into the details, is that automakers don't take the time to properly aim their headlights. But you guys know, at the end of every assembly line, one of the last things is you set the toe and camber and adjust the headlamp. So what do they mean by that?
I don't know. I think part of it, they pointed out, like, for example, and they used the Optima as an example, that you know, which has these clever headlights that actually track as you turn the wheel of the car. But they discovered that it creates glare, which is not helpful in terms of seeing things. I mean, it's just
glare for the oncoming driver.
Right. And the thing of it is that, I mean, every automaker right now is chasing lighting technology. And it seems to me they're chasing lighting technology largely as a decorative thing. I mean, and we got to credit.
All about styling.
We got to credit Audi. I mean, when they came out with those LED daytime running lights, I mean, that was just the bomb. I mean, it's just so sensational. They should have patented that idea, and then Volkswagen could have paid all its bills because everyone wants to have something that has a light signature, right? Using LEDs.
Yeah, you know,
this guy started it, but basic seeing. I mean, this is what it comes down to. I mean, they're talking about, you know, down the road presence.
But what was interesting too is it wasn't just the luxury brands, but also the LED lights and the adaptive headlights to the road, also not necessarily any better than the traditional halogen lamps.
Right. See, I find that hard to believe, only because, you know, we all test a bunch of cars, and driving at night, some cars are clearly better than others, and it tends to be, I think, from my experience, the ones with the more expensive headlamps on them. I'm going to have to pay more attention, clearly.
The thing I'm going to have to start tracking.
Well, and hats off to the IIHS for doing this. And they put the metrics out there, you know, both, you know, in almost test lab kind of conditions and out on the road. So kudos to them. I mean, they got the data to show it.
You know, and to your point, Pete, I mean, they said one of the best headlight systems evaluated has none of the new technology. The basic halogen lights on the Honda Accord four-door earn an acceptable rating. Now, that's not good, but it's acceptable. While an LED system with high beam assist available on the Accord earns only marginal.
Whoa.
So,
whoa.
You know, so now I'm sure the LED system looks really cool. Right. I mean, just like, oh,
yeah, but still,
well,
this
to your
is
point, this is decorative and not safety minded. That's probably the perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what those LED headlamps on an Audi A7 or A8 cost? Replacement costs, dealer replacement costs, $3,500 for each side. So you're talking about $7,000 replacement cost. Dealer. This is dealer markup and all that. But so,
and for $3,000 more, you get ludicrous mode on. No, it's just right.
Speaking of ludicrous mode, we did get some comments and questions here. Robert says Tesla's got the superchargers on the freeways, which permits the long distance. Does Bolt have that? No, you know, he's just weighing in. Tony says we were talking about sales. Tesla does not have the distribution that Chevrolet has. And to your point, Pete, you know, you can't buy Teslas in every state. Chevy is everywhere.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think watching some of those squabbles between the dealers and Tesla state by state that they've had over the last few years, you know, it probably really hasn't mattered all that much because the Model S is 70,000 plus. Maybe now is, you know, really when it starts to matter, is when we have two cars that are very similar going head to head as Tesla tries to enter more of a mass market.
Well, we'll know a whole lot more tonight. Actually, I will know more tomorrow morning, because their late Pacific Coast press conference is going to be when I'm in bed, probably.
Pete will be watching.
I think not that I'm going to be joining John, but I will also be in my bed. You know, kids go to sleep, I go to sleep. I'm not staying up to watch something remotely.
That's right.
All right, damn it, I'll have to watch.
Hey, we've burned up a perfectly good hour here. Burned it up in a good way, though. So probably time to wrap this up. But it was really cool having Mike Downey and the Pacifica in here. Mm-hmm. I'm jealous that you guys have driven the thing, because I have not yet, and I'm dying. And I, back in an earlier part of my life, when the kids were still at home, we had a town and country. So mm-hmm. I'm dying to see how this thing drives.
Because, well, I give them credit. I mean, they took us on roads that... Yeah. You know, you wouldn't take a minivan on ordinarily. I mean, that was my sense of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the fact that, you know, we started out on some, we come off the ramp from one highway onto some acceleration lanes or on ramps going straight up some hills. And, you know, the increased power really made it an easy transition from one to the other.
He was right when he was talking about, you know, building the solid bones under that thing. And it was very impressive.
Well, that's what I like about this show, getting somebody like a Mike Downey, and chief engineer. I mean, here's the guy that ran the whole engineering effort on it, and then having the vehicle in the studio, too. It's a great way to do it. Okay, let's wrap it up.
All right.
Pete Bigelow from Autoblog. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Great having you here, man.
Thank you.
And, Gary, let's do this again next week.
Indeed we shall.
Cool. Okay, I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.